Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Rad Gontos.
Hey, Paul Roberts. So for anybody out there that's very confused at this point, because we looked like we popped our head out of the hole and then we disappeared back into that. Well, you know, we're not groundhogs here, but we had a bit of technical difficulties coinciding the video feed with the audio.
We're struggling with video.
We took care of it. This is why we call it live radio. Because it's how the sausage is made sometimes, you know. So you get a little bit more than you tuned in for. In any case, thanks for Paul for sorting that out. Always jumping in, trying to take care of it right away. And he does not get enough credit, I think, for that, being behind the camera and behind the mic.
So trying thanks, to do Paul, everything here.
Yeah. He's a one man magic show. So without further ado, though, I would like to get to my guest. Gentleman that I had the pleasure of having lunch with, and we've had a couple conversations, and I think it's interesting how, you know, I say this all the time about the show, that it's just you got to be open to receive where life takes you and people that you meet. And if you're fortunate enough to be able to have people come your way that are authentic, that are candid,
where do you find
the courage to actually kind of put themselves out there?
Where
and
do
just
you
be
find
themselves?
Those people?
Huh?
Where do you find those people?
Well, you actually have to leave Orange County. No, I'm just kidding. Believe it or not, we actually exist in Orange County. I think it's just a human condition. You know, we were talking about this at lunch. Ben Bobo is my guest on the show. Ben, it's great to have you.
Thank you.
We were talking about this even at lunch, where you know, as you get older. This is an aging show. Did you know that?
Yes.
Yeah. So you know, you're getting older by the minute.
Yes.
There, but yeah. But as we get older, we tend to become a little bit more discerning about people that we interact with, and it's not so much a personal affront to anybody, but you don't have time for energy vampires and people that are just kind of like the whirling dervishes that are just constantly.
In motion, constantly spinning.
And nothing wrong with people that are constantly in motion, by the way. It doesn't mean just preface that are in good motion. Right. There's people just started like, you know, like what do they call those things? Like, not black holes. What do they call those things?
They call them Donald Trump.
Yeah, Donald Trump's now. black holes. You get too close to that kind of energy, and it just kind of, at the very least, sucks up your energy and it takes you away from what you're passionate about. So fortunate. Thank you for being on the show. It's great meeting you. And I want to give you a chance to just lay a little groundwork before we get into what you are doing right now.
Sure.
Okay. Give a little background about yourself, because I think you've had your own journey, if you will.
Yeah, you know, we all have our own journey for sure. And the journey, if we're not real people, authentic people, if one's smart, eventually the journey leads you to a much more authentic place.
You know, life has a way, doesn't it?
It has a way of carving out the sharp edges.
Yeah.
And that's why you give a lot of grace to people that are going through that journey, no matter what stage they're in. But my journey from a professional standpoint started out going to school in Utah. I went to an ROTC program with Air Force. Mm-hmm. Graduated number one in that program to lead me to a place called Euronato Joint Jet Pilot Training.
Absolutely.
And I had the joy of having an Italian flight instructor, a German flight commander, and they're diametrically opposed people. So at a very young age, I learned that you had to have a lot of flexibility when you're flying in a plane, because what you're taught from one wasn't always agreeable by the other. And so it really taught you a lot about flexibility, about personalities at a very young age.
Yeah.
And having had that honor and that blessing to be in the Air Force and pilot training, go through that process.
Where were you stationed?
I was at Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls, Texas.
And what did you fly?
T-37s. A lot of fun, a lot of lessons. In fact, on my third flight with my Italian flight instructor, who had 4,000 hours in an F-104 that they flew in Italy. We were out in the practice area doing acrobatics, aileron rolls, loops, you name it. And as we're coming back into the traffic pattern, he started exhibiting different characteristics. And he had gotten pretty sick. And the result was we're about 1,000 feet porpoising in the plane. If you can visualize porpoising at 1,000 feet above the ground, and he expelled his contents in the cockpit. Mm-hmm. So we landed, and that was interesting when we landed, and we went back to the flight commander. He burst up in laughter. The flight instructor went home, and after that, I paid a price on multiple flights thereafter. Because, you know, students are the ones that are supposed to be the ones that go through that experience, and not the
and
flight instructors.
And porpoising is when you take a dive, and then you suddenly pull up, and you go up and down and up and down.
And we're about 240 knots, porpoising 1,000 feet above the ground in the traffic pattern, so that was exciting.
Yeah, not really subtle.
Not really subtle. But luckily, we lived to die another day, and we came through that, and that was an interesting experience.
So how long were you there for?
In the Air Force, totals 6 years. Okay. I was also at Hill Air Force Base in Utah, sure. And then, of course, ROTC at University of Utah.
Very cool. And what did you do after university?
So after that, after the Air Force, I joined a company called Milliken & Company, mm-hmm. and I went there because in 89, they won the Malcolm Baldrige Award. And that's a National Quality Award, by the way, and is a distinction.
And for people who don't know what that is, Ben.
So the Malcolm Baldrige Award was really designed to encourage companies in really identifying the cost of quality, improving their quality systems, a la Deming, who, as we all remember, Deming went to Japan after World War II mm-hmm. and really helped the Japanese get back on solid footing from their quality systems and what they produced.
Only after we refused to listen to them here.
That's right. Exactly right. And so Deming was a big influencer on the founder of Milliken & Company, Roger Milliken. Mm-hmm. And so hence came the Quality Award nationally. The government, the Congress established it to encourage companies in America
to listen.
To listen, to up their quality systems and what they're producing.
Very cool. And how long were you there for?
I was with Milliken & Company about 2.5 years, and mm-hmm. we're kind of in the hospitality space. They produce a lot of different things, but in this case, it was carpet tiles, and I was focused
on... Absolutely. They're a big name in that industry.
Big name. Post-sale service, making the carpet tiles look beautiful in Vegas.
Yep.
And so, and the idea being if you did that, they'd be repeat customers.
What did you do for them?
I was a post-sale service consultant. So we went out and asked...
You got the calls from people like me.
We got the calls from people like you.
Who bought this stuff and had questions.
We had questions or it's sustained or something's wrong with it. So did that for a couple years.
No, I've used that product. I've been in hospitality since probably about 94. And you can't miss... Milliken. I mean, it's just it's everywhere. So, and it's a good product. The company really definitely. I mean, it's interesting that there's a culture of that is also basically recognized on the industry level, because from a end user or a specifier side, it was always a good experience dealing with that company.
Yes.
Yeah. And so what happens after 2.5 years?
So from there, you know, you kind of have that part in life. You say, is what I'm doing meaningful? Is it making a difference in people's lives?
How old are you?
At that time, I was about 25, I would say. And so you kind of go through that transition, like, what is it I'm doing that really makes an impact? So I looked at a number of MBA programs, got accepted to a few of them, and started looking at medical devices, something that would directly touch people's lives.
That's so interesting. Why that?
Well, I think part of it was the influence of my father in my life. He was a medical device executive over at Edwards, and I'd seen glimpses of what that looks like, nowhere near the level of what he was going through on a daily basis, but I saw the impact of medical device technology on people's outcomes from surgery or quality of life, because that's ultimately what matters the most.
Yeah.
And so as I was looking at my alternatives, I was looking at medical device, maybe going into sales, also pursuing an MBA a degree at the time. And so what happened was I met a gentleman over at Edwards who interviewed me, and he had a position called associate sales rep. So I'd gotten a number of acceptances to an MBA programs. And, of course, my dad spoke into my life as dads do. And he said, well, he goes, there's an opportunity cost. He goes, you can go do that MBA, and you're going to pay 2 years of full-time tuition, room and board, and you lose the 2 years you'd get in your current sales role. And so that's the opportunity cost. Or you can go to a company, do an MBA part-time and have them pay for it. And that's exactly what I did.
That's great advice.
It was great advice. And it's not, for some people like to go full-time.
No, but it's great advice. And kudos for your dad for basically being a guiding light in helping you with that decision. Because traditionally you'd say, okay, your focus is on one thing. This was like, well, you could actually have both. It's going to take a little longer to get there. And you don't have a high opportunity cost in that manner.
Right.
You'll pay for it in a different way because you won't have a life, really, for the time that you're there. How long did it take you to get your MBA?
Got it in 2.5 years.
Oh, it's still pretty quick.
So
that's
was
good.
Was doing school, working full time, and had a small family.
Was there support on the company side too, from in terms of you going to school?
Yeah, 100%. In fact, Edwards paid for a year of it, and then I was with a startup called Cardiothoracic Systems that paid for the second year of it.
So another bonus, really.
Another bonus. Yeah.
It's great. Kudos to your dad for doing that. And I'm really kind of interested because, you know, I remember going to do my MBA, and I remember, like, you know, I don't know that medical devices was sort of in my foreground, and it makes sense if that's something that you were exposed to with your dad.
Yeah.
I have sort of similar connectivity to civil engineering. I never pursued it, but I know what that feels like. It's like, it's the what you know.
Right.
And so you gravitate towards that as you're making a pair, because it is a paradigm shift. I mean, you got your undergrad, you're working, now you're like looking for that next thing to do. And wait, hold on. Didn't I get done with all my schooling? No, I guess I'm not yet, right?
No, that's exactly right. You know, what's funny is you get to certain points in your career and you realize in your early 20s or mid 20s, you really have to start focusing on what's that pathway.
Mm-hmm.
Because certain industries like medical device, if you're not in early and you don't have the teachings and learnings they provide, whether it be marketing, sales, business development.
Yeah.
If you don't get in early, it's hard to crack into. So I was at a point, inflection point.
Well, the entry levels are finite. And it's pharmaceuticals is another one.
Yep.
Sort of similar, especially if you want to make a career path into that, especially under a corporate structure.
Right.
You kind of have to get in when you still have the time to put in the time.
Right.
To make it through the system. Yeah, no, it's true. And it's interesting. I think that's one of those things that seems to have been somewhat lost, but I think it's being relearned. When we went through that sort of that whole dot-com boom, where I remember people that were starting their career paths, and I'm looking at them, and they're shifting gears, and they're dropping from one to the other every 3 months, every 6 months, kind of just literally, stepping stones, higher, lower, whatever, and there was no foundational, and at some point, you know, a lot of them suffered because now you're looking at their resume when the market got tight. You're looking at their resume, and I was like, you didn't have any retention, any one spot more than 3 to 6 months.
Yeah.
It was a clever move because you got to something else, but it was not a sustainable move.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I want to ask you another question, Ben, because we're talking about this right now, Justin, and you brought it up, so. I told you sometimes a show will take, you know, paths that I don't know where we're going to go, right? But this is actually, you're making me think about this. You said that at some point in your life, like 25 or in your 20s, you're starting to have sort of a wherewithal and awareness that you need to pick a path. You need to get on a path. You need to start taking steps that are constructive towards something, right? What happens to us later in life? Why do we stop doing that? Because at some point we stop doing that. And I think currently we have a lot of people that are industries that are basically, kaput, industries that are no longer viable, but they're older. And so what causes us to basically stop being that open?
Yeah, that's a philosophical question, isn't it? I think, you know, when you're younger, you're probably
I was trying to get that question out because you kind of triggered something. And
yeah.
I'm like thinking, and I'm guilty of it too. I mean, you know, you tend to be, you start getting a little bit more resistant to that.
No, that is the fundamental question, I think, of life. I mean, if you think about life, life's about growth. I mean, I didn't stop at walking or crawling.
Right.
But we all grow, and we all grow at different rates and levels. And I think our environment also encourages or discourages us to grow.
Yeah.
And so you ask a quintessential question. If the economy shifts or changes, how do people keep their motivation to keep moving forward? When things don't work out in that one career aspect, how do you transition and reform yourself, if you will, or brand yourself?
And be open to that.
And be open to it.
If not even better, excited about that. You know, it's not a challenge, it's actually an opportunity. You know, it's like the old cliche, it's not a challenge, it's an opportunity, it's not a problem, it's a solution, it's a chance. But yeah, no, I mean, I, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot to give me an answer, it was an interesting thing that you said, and it just kind of hit me.
I'll tell you, let me just mention this. There's a book called Growth Mindset, and I can't remember the author's name, but she was on TED. And Growth Mindset talks about the two different mindsets that you think you find with people. One group of people could be a victim to their whole entire life circumstances. Mm-hmm. I can find somebody who is homeless, who struggled their whole life, yet their attitude is just sky high. And the way they view the world is just amazing with potential.
Yeah.
And so there's the victim mindset, and then there's a growth mindset that says, no matter what I go through in life, whatever setback, and we all have them, that I'm going to look at that as an opportunity to grow and learn. And the people that come across my path are really amazing beings, because I don't believe everything is just sort of happenstance.
No.
It's design. It's grand design. And so that's just how I look at it. So I think to all of us, as we age, there's an opportunity, especially in America, to be what you want to be and take those lessons and take the attitude is the most important part, right? You mentioned earlier, do you want to hang out with people that are vampires? My answer is no. But do I want to hang out with people that are humble, authentic, and recognize your limitations? Because I know most people were more than happy to reach out and help somebody or give advice if asked. So there's the opportunity. I think therein lies the opportunity as well.
Well, and so you obviously have been open to things, because you, in what you're doing today, in a way, it sort of exemplifies that, right? It's not what you were doing then.
Right. Well, here's something I learned in the Air Force as a young pup. I went flying one time, and we all got back, and they said, Lieutenant Bobo, they said, flexibility is the key to air power. He goes, when you get in a plane, some days it's going to be a clear day, and in Texas, it'll go to inclement weather, and it'll go to clouds, and you got to be prepared. So one of the things I learned is you got to be flexible and that you got to be open. And when things shift that weren't supposed to happen in your mind's eye, what you have to do is change the roadmap. See, we get these blueprints in our brains about how life is supposed to be. And when the blueprint shifts or changes and our blueprint's solid and,
which they always
and inflexible, that's where stress comes in. But if I can change my blueprint, my roadmap to the new realities, I kind of go with the flow like the dolphins. I'm not interested in being a salmon swimming against the stream. I'm really interested in going with the flow of what life gives you. And if you do that, you meet amazing people along the way. It's a lot more enjoyable.
So what does the Air Force do to get that point across? I mean, I'm guessing not everybody that walks in there has basically got that attitude.
No, I think they attract a lot of people that have a similar mindset, but then they attract a lot of people that don't. And I think there's a lot of training with impressionable young minds that's helpful, where it's very very structured. You wear certain clothes. You do certain things at certain times. They strip the individuality away, and now you're part of a team because you're all using the same uniform. You're all doing you salute the same. You follow the same rules of the road. But the other thing that the military does is they put you in challenging situations, and it's designed to not only break you down but build you up, because when they put you in those situations, you realize that if you can go through that and you see yourself on the other side of that, that no matter what hits you in life, you can go through it.
Well, it's interesting what you how you just presented that, because the first part of what you said almost would lead somebody to think it's just churning out a repeat clone one after the other. But that's almost, it sounds like it's almost like the basis. And then you are put into those challenging situations to have that individuality actually come out and that muscle to be trained.
Exactly. Well said. I can't say any better. That's exactly right. Yeah. You know, you got to take the group and you got to train them the Air Force way or the Marine way or the Army way. But in each of those armed services, there's a lot of different disciplines they have to have. You need pilots, you need mechanics, you need software engineers, you need aerospace engineers. So, but they need to have the basic structure in place where you got command and control, and that people aren't going to go off the reservation. I mean, after all, they're dealing with nuclear weapons, and
there's some gravity to them doing that.
Yes.
Yeah. The reason I'm just kind of like hovering over this a little bit, Ben, is we've had the privilege of having some people that are veterans or people that are still involved in, you know, like supporting their brothers and sisters and through the GI Bill. I had a gentleman who basically handles that program, was a former vet, a couple of tours of duty in Iraq and Kuwait, and he basically is sort of a liaison for the GI program down at San Marcos. Really nice guy, and I see it also in a lot of some of the schools because of the GI Bill. You know, I teach at the Art Institute here in Costa Mesa, and we've got people that are, you know, it's a veterans program, and they're going into culinary, they're going into things like that, and there is definitely something to be said for what those people, because of the discipline that they have been put through, bring to the table. I totally understand why people look at people that are former veterans. And we had a gentleman by the name of Josh Newman, who was a state congressman for a while.
Yeah.
And Josh came in and he had a nonprofit where he was helping veterans, basically, him being a veteran himself, transition into workforce. And so having that discipline, having that background, getting that across to corporate America that there's a value in this asset. And that openness that we're talking about is a big part of it. It's the discipline, it's the commitment, but it's also that openness that dealing with those situations as they come without losing your cool, without not, you know, losing the fact that it's a solution-driven situation. That's amazing. And I think it really speaks to what you are doing now, because what you're doing now, you know, and I want to take, are we going to take a break, Paul, or no? Let's take a break and come back, because I really think I was blown away that it wasn't being done already.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
Yeah. So let's take a break and we'll come back with Ben Bobo.
When you use the Premier Rewards Gold Card from American Express, the rewards points can keep on multiplying. By 3 with triple points on airfare, by 2 with double points on gas and groceries, and a single point for pretty much every other dollar you spend on the card. Then, start choosing from over 1 million rewards to redeem all those points. Apply today and the annual fee for the first year is on us. Call 1-800-AXP-GOLD or visit axpgold.com. The annual fee for the card is $175. See terms, conditions, and restrictions at axpgold.com.
Imagine what it would feel like to lose everything. Your job, your home, your family, your dignity. This has happened to thousands of the men, women, veterans, and young adults we serve at Working Wardrobes. What do we do to help? We provide career development services, life skills workshops, job skills training. We provide the perfect interview outfit, and we get clients placed in jobs. Call Working Wardrobes, 714-210-2460. Donate, volunteer, invest. Higher.
Imagine buying a newspaper and discovering that the news you're reading is 6 months old. There isn't much that stays the same for 6 months. And the same thing goes for background checks. In a time when so much outdated information is being passed around, it's good to know that People G2 offers something different. At People G2, we provide today's intelligence, not yesterday's news. Our value-added approach offers you a fully FCRA-compliant solution that includes up-to-the-minute information. By combining industry-leading technology with old-school human investigation, People G2 is able to give you information that is accurate right now, delivered quickly to our online system or integrated with your HR system. So ask yourself, are you comfortable working with old news, or are you ready for a different kind of background check company? Visit peopleg2.com or call 800-630-2880. That's 800-630-2880 or peopleg2.com.
And we are back on The Rad Life with Mr. Ben Bobo. If you are just joining us, Ben and I were talking about a whole bunch of stuff, but we were really, before the break, we were talking about the importance of basically being open to taking risks, and that I really, as I get older, I really believe that that is a muscle that you have to train. You cannot just wake up one morning and all of a sudden become a risk taker. And most people, human condition is probably resistant to change, even though we all laugh because the only constant is change, but we're all kind of resistant. We still have this sort of, I think, you know, DNA level of deniability about the fact that, you know, somehow we'll navigate through without change, right?
Right, yeah. Right.
It's all, change is the only constant. We're talking about that. We're talking about Ben's background as being in the Air Force and how that was basically something that was very rewarding and at the same time left him with those skill sets and ingrained that basically allow him to do what he's doing today, which is what, Ben?
So what I'm doing today is I'm president and CEO of a company called Serenitex, Inc., and we're focused on a non-invasive way of detecting migraines using artificial intelligence.
Let's give people the website, too. What's the website for
the website? The website is www.serenitex.com. That's Serenitex.com.
Yeah, go check it out. But yeah, so it's like you're saying, it's a new way to evaluate migraines.
Yes.
With using what kind of technology?
So what we do is we use acoustics, and we take the acoustics and run it through artificial intelligence, and mm-hmm. we can look at, through pattern recognition, we can look at changes within the brain as compared to a normal person. So when we understand migraines, a migraine event is where you have a vascular event, and the vasculature in the brain is very reactive for a migrainer. And what happens when they're having an active migraine is the vessels vasodilate or get bigger and impinge upon the nerve endings, which is what gives you that thumping pain. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the over-the-counter medicine has caffeine in it, and it creates a vasoconstriction, and caffeine also helps to reduce the pain. So today people would be shocked if they understood that when they diagnose migraines, mm-hmm. there is no diagnostic tool. It's all subjective. It's a mm-hmm. swag. And they're giving them antidepressants, they're giving them opioids, and they're giving them migraine abortive drugs, which actually can cause strokes.
And yet, what you described as the basis of what basically is a migraine is relatively simple to understand.
Yes.
And I don't know that a lot of people actually that suffer, unless they have been told or they have had the interest, all they know is that there's a throbbing pain that I basically am trying to get rid of, and whatever it takes, because it is, if you have suffered from a migraine, you know. I mean, it is a debilitating.
And you know. Yeah.
You know. Is this something that you have dealt with personally?
I've not. I mean, I've had tension headaches. Yeah. You know, you get stress. No, I've had people that I've known that have had migraines, and it's debilitating.
Likewise, my father for forever and ever has suffered from migraines. I fortunately have not been, but I have seen people that go through it, and it is very debilitating. I mean, it's like light, nothing, noise, light. It really is, and yet the principle of it is relatively simple.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about that, you know. Most people, my father included, you know, try to convince them that there's also a nutritional component.
Yes.
You know, what you eat, the diet that you're on, you know, affects your blood flow. It affects your constrictions. So I am astounded, and I've told this to you, I'm astounded that as long as migraines have been around, I mean, and they've been around long enough that, you know, they find skulls from ancient dig sites that have holes bored into their heads, right?
Right.
I mean, yeah, it's been around for a long time.
Right.
That there has not been this kind of data collection.
Yeah, and what's driving it, so if you think about it, today we can get our blood pressure checked by an objective quantitative device called the blood pressure cuff.
Yeah.
And on that basis, you may get blood pressure medicine.
Right.
But since you have to go through the skull.
And you can monitor and regulate it.
Yeah. And so since you have to go through the skull, there's been nothing that really gives a neurosurgeon, neurologist, definitive agreement whether you have that pathology or not. So with the advent of AI, and the way we're approaching detecting the migraine, it's really artificial intelligence intelligence and the algorithms today, which came about 3 years ago,
mm-hmm.
that makes all this possible.
So it's also timing on the technology.
It's
technology
timing on the technology.
Was not around.
Correct.
To do what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Where are you guys at with this? Is it an R&D? Where are you at as far as the development of this technology?
Great question. So we just got through a proof of concept study, which showed we can actually detect migraines with the approach we're taking. We could also detect the impact of RX therapy or drugs on the migraine, which I think a lot of drug companies would be interested
in.
Absolutely. And right now we're going through another study as part of the R&D work.
Mm.
I'm currently in the seed round of funding, on our way to raise $2 million to complete the development work and get into a clinical study. And speaking of which, we're enrolling patients in MINDS 2 study. And MINDS is Migraine Intelligent Non-Invasive Diagnostic Study. Is based out of Santa Ana. We're at a sound recording studio. So anybody listening to this, mm-hmm. if you know anybody with a chronic migraine defined as 15 migraines a month or every day, we would welcome the opportunity to have you come to the study and participate. You can go there going to study@serenitex.com, or you can call the number, which I'm looking at right now, 949-538-5600, extension 107.
Let's give that number again.
949-538-5600.
And spell the name of the company. You threw that out.
Hold on a second, Paul. Let's finish the number.
Okay.
Let's do it again.
949-538-5600, extension 107. And it's study@serenitex.com, C-E-R-E-N-E-T-E-X.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. That is really fascinating. What kind of percentage of population do you think suffer?
It's about 10%. So 40 million people in the U.S. Let's break it down. 4 million get chronic migraines. That means 15 times a month or every day.
Mm-hmm.
And 36 million get it once or twice a month. Now, we think about that.
Mm-hmm.
When you get a migraine in one day, it takes about 2 to 3 days of recovery because you're on migraine abortive drugs, you're medicated, and you're trying to get it out of that fog. So
right.
It's a big impact. Worldwide, 1 billion people suffer from migraines. So it's a huge, huge impact on, you know, a worldwide basis.
And the medication that you're talking about, the medication that's prescribed subjectively by physicians, is that medication specific to migraines? Or is it medication for other things that also has a potential benefit for migraines?
It's both. It's specific to migraines, or you can take a blood pressure medicine, which is known to reduce migraines. But today, whether it be a neurologist or a primary care physician,
right.
It's a complete swag. Let me share an interesting study. Allergan, which is the manufacturer of Botox, Botox is given to migraineurs every 3 months. And they just did the Cameo study in 2018 this year. They got an award for it. And it showed that less than 5% of active migraineurs are even diagnosed or treated for the condition. That means a lot of these people are going to primary care physicians. Primary care physicians are not interested in giving neurological drugs because they're not as familiar because there's some deleterious effects. And as a result, they put patients on pain management, opioids, and antidepressants. It's not really solving the
problem. It's not really solving the problem. It's just masking the pain.
It's masking the pain.
Or managing the pain.
Right.
Yeah. Paul, let's give people the number for the station in case they want to call.
949-330-7761. 949-330-7761. Operators standing by.
Yeah, if you got any questions for Ben or if you are dealing with this yourself, give us a call. Like I said, I have had secondhand experience with this because of my father, as long as you know I remember, has always dealt with this on occasions. And there's stress components to it. There's temperature components to it. There's altitude components to it. There's a lot of stuff that just being around, you realize that there's certain things that could trigger. And like I said, nutrition is one of them. And yet I don't see a lot of basically reprogramming on the nutritional side or anything of that nature that addresses this. I would have thought that the numbers were higher, not that the numbers are small. But it's interesting. I wonder if that plays a role in this a little bit. Like, you're talking about 4 million people. Okay? That's a small number in a country of 400 million, right? Which makes something of this nature has got to be somewhat risky. Like, I mean, if you're looking at, I don't know that you can see Ben, but I'm looking at Ben. He's got a little twinkle in his eye because, it's like there's definitely a risk factor to this, right? It's from venture capital, from an investment perspective, to take on something of this nature, there's a risk factor to it, right?
Yeah, it's huge risk. I mean, by definition, a startup is if you saw a startup, just think risk because you have a proposition or a premise. You have a belief that if you take a certain technological approach to the problem, it'll solve it. And in this phase, you got to convince investors. So it's a chicken and egg, right? To do the development work, to prove the proof of concept, you need money. To get money, you got to show results in development work, and you got to show the proof of concept. So it's a very risky venture when anybody who does a medical device startup, or any startup for that matter, is going out there with a premise or hypothesis that says, we believe with this approach, we'll get this outcome. And sometimes you don't really know until you've done the R&D work and the testing.
Right.
And yet you still have to court the investors. And obviously keep them up to date as you're doing the development work.
And there has to be some substantiated, quantifiable results that basically continue to keep you in the game, basically.
Yes.
Till you get to a point where there's a, I would think, a critical mass of results that basically now speak for themselves.
Right.
And there's a certain amount of faith in that, both in terms of the people that are investing into it and people that are basically pursuing it.
Right.
Why are you comfortable in that space?
Well, I've done startups since going back to 96. I did my first startup at Sendex in Carlsbad, California, and then moved to a company called Cardiothoracic Systems. And since then, I've been with Six. I'm a three-time CEO. So, you're kind of familiar with what you know.
Yeah.
And it's always been risk. So it's like when you talk to a migraineur, how do you do that every day? It's what we know.
Well, it's a muscle that you continue to develop, right?
It's a muscle, right?
Definitely.
And it's quite different than a big, large company medical device experience versus a startup. So more risk, you move at a much different pace. And I feel like I would describe my role as a plate spinner. I have like six plates spinning at the same time.
You
my
too,
job
huh?
is to keep them all spinning.
Yeah.
So, by the way, there's a regulatory aspect to this. We still have to get approval of this device with the FDA.
Yeah.
And there's risk with that. So you mitigate
You might
risk.
Not get approved.
You may not get approved. So you mitigate the risk by a lot of smart people talking about the strategy and how we're going to approach the agency. Because ultimately, having a non-invasive device that provides this kind of benefit. By the way, it's pathology specific. Eventually, we can look at Parkinson, Alzheimer's, dementia, depression, all of those by changing the algorithm. So it has huge implications.
Right. Well, and people will always ask me, like, well, Rod, but what has that got to do with the Rad Life? And it's like, isn't that a baby boomer aging show or whatever? Well, it's actually me getting older and things I find interesting, and therefore I bring them here. But there is actually a direct connection, and in many times our guests, there is some connection. In this particular case, you're dealing with somebody like my dad, who's in their 80s, they have suffered from this for majority of their lives. There's definitely a reduction in quality of life. And as you get older, your thresholds for pain, your ways of dealing with stuff, your frustration levels, your sense of depression, you're basically, a senior, you're at home, you don't have all the other thing. Now you're even more have a propensity to be in a state of depression. So you go in and you get medicated. And then that medication basically is now in, you know, did I take my medication? Did I not take my medication? Do I have beginning of dementia? Am I remembering? You know, who, you know, all of these factors factor in. In fact, we've had discussion on the show where the largest growing opioid problem in the United States is with seniors.
Right.
Not with kids.
Right.
It's with seniors and with over prescribed medications, with wrongful dispensing of medication, taking of medication, management of all kinds of stuff. So there's definitely a senior component to this, and it has a direct, like you're saying, with Parkinson's, you know, anything that is mind and cognitive based, this is not helping right. if you're struggling with the situation, right? Let me ask you this. I don't know. I'm pretty sure that it is the case, but I don't know that I can call out an example. But you mentioned the fact that, you know, it's a startup, it's a small in a medical device situation, there's always the risk factor. How many things that we take for granted today that are technologies that we just assume are daily parts of our lives actually started off in that capacity?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. So let's think about Apple when Steve Jobs was around, and you say, well, that was kind of a startup company to a point, and then it turned
into it was in
big,
a garage.
Yeah, big conglomerate.
Yeah.
Yet you had a visionary founder who kept it sort of like a startup. One hit after another, one innovation after another. That's a rarity in big, large companies because what they focus on is quarterly results to Wall Street.
Shareholders.
They got to protect their current revenue streams. And so their risk tolerance to invest in really out their technology concepts really isn't there. That's why you have startups that sort of fill that void. And a lot of the breakthroughs you see are startups that started with a vision from a founder that got backed by venture capital or investors that you'll see, you know, YouTube or Apple or Google picking up. I mean, if you look at how many companies Google has consumed over the last 2 years alone, that kind of gives you some indication how they plan on keeping a dominant position in the market. So for startups, it really starts with an idea, taking a big risk. And by the way, about 2/3 of the startups fail. I mean, it's not a big hit rate. But there is a recipe for success for those that are successful. And luckily, we have a team of amazing people at Serenitechs that have done this before, specific to startups, that really have the discipline. So when you think about a non-invasive AI-based company, what I think about is, what are the people you need to have that are expert in those areas? Digital signal processing, algorithm development, audio. I mean, this is, it's an audio-based, acoustic device.
Yeah.
So it's really about finding those right skill sets to power the project.
Well, and bring them together in the right way with guidance and direction, but still openness, because it is in a very much an experimental kind of situation. Right?
Well said. Yeah. I mean, that's spot on. Because if you don't, if you're dictatorial in your control, you'll never be successful.
You can't do that. Right, exactly. That. And that's probably in some parts, some of the failures of those startups. They're great ideas, but then if you don't have the management culture that basically will not only sustain, but allow those kind of individual inputs and breakthroughs to exist, then you don't have the environment for that to basically flourish.
My role of a CEO is service-centered leadership. It's not about me. It's about promoting the people. I'm hiring the smartest people I can find. And I know there's things I don't know.
Yeah.
I go find those people that do know. It's real simple. And you just promote them and what they're doing, and you give them leeway
to
be creative and get out of their way.
Yeah. So what would you say in that role, what would you share as being something that, what maybe one or two things that you learned along the way doing this, that you basically like believe in wholeheartedly on a daily basis in your execution of your job?
So from a CEO leadership standpoint, well, you know, it's from what you learn from people that maybe weren't so quality. I think a lot of executives bring their ego into the process and their net worth, and they equate net worth with self-worth, and they get it conflicted. Mm-hmm. What I believe is you got to be transparent, you got to be humble, you got to be real, you got to be authentic. And it's not about me, it's not about ego. You know, by the way, if this does well and people do well as investors, which we hope they do, that doesn't change your daily life. I mean, you could have $40 million in the bank and you still have the same problems you have. It's all between your ears.
I love what you just said. Your net worth is not your self-worth.
And so if you keep that in mind, that it's not about ego, it's not about my title or position, it's about somehow this all came together with the right people. Co-founder Dr. Moishan Shah, who's a neurosurgeon out of Orange County Global, we met and we brought this together. It's really about those people. And all I'm doing is I'm sort of like the quarterback or the band leader, trying to make sure we're playing on the right notes.
Which is a critical role.
And make sure from a philosophical standpoint, you walk with humility, because I see that mistake in corporate America. There's a lot of big egos out there. And here's what's funny, and I'll end on this. All these people that are super wealthy, they've done really well. They're completely out of touch with how people really think about them. And if the goal in life is to be liked and respected and feel connected, Money is the biggest impediment to that happening. So that's what I've learned is that, you know, no matter how much money you have in the bank account, it doesn't matter because tomorrow I could be dead. So how I live my life right now in this moment and how I treat people and how I leave people feeling,
yep.
That's what my lesson is from a CEO.
Thank you very much for sharing that, Ben. I think it's no truer words. And sometimes in the course of just being on the hamster wheel, sometimes we lose touch with that. You know, there's way too much judgment out there. There's way too much... sense of grandness, but at somebody else's cost. There's way too much of that, and there's really no reason for it. You know, I know people that are with a high net worth. They're the most nicest people on the planet, and it's not the measure. It's another happenstance. It just happens to be.
Right.
But that's not what you value.
Right.
Really, at the end. And you're right. I mean, you know, we joke about this on the show. It's like none of us are getting out alive. Yeah, none of us are getting out alive.
Right.
But it's, what is the legacy you're leaving behind you?
Exactly. That's
right?
Exactly it.
Right. With that being said, I mean, I don't know. I had a bunch of other questions for you, honestly. And I was like, but the one question I do have, and it's relevant to the company, how long have you guys been doing this?
So I founded the company in March of this year.
Okay.
And so that's, you know, what's that, 8-9 months?
So that sounds like you guys have covered a lot of ground in the last 8 months.
Yeah, we've raised money. We have a proof of concept study.
Yeah,
we're now
huge.
Moving towards a working demo prototype, an app we're creating right now that'll be available in January. We have another investor gala happening in Beverly Hills in January.
Okay.
So we have a lot of activity. For investors, it's all about getting results.
How do you go after your investors? Is it very selectively, basically, reaching out to people?
At this phase, it's friends and family. It's people that know, or neurologists or neurosurgeons, yeah. or people that have heard that believe in the people,
mm-hmm.
that have seen some of the evidence, that get involved, people that have been touched by migraines. So to about the first million or so, you look for friends and family. And then at that point, I can open up to angels and private equity families or...
Right.
private office money.
And will you be at that point in January or not yet?
We're going to be entering into that phase in February.
Uh-huh.
I'll be working with Tech Coast Angels to present to those guys.
Okay.
And also, we have some family offices that are interested. Again, those guys don't want to be the fat boy in the waiting pool.
Of course not.
They don't want to have all the money in. They want to make
not.
Sure there's
yeah.
other people.
Yeah, yeah.
So we'll be at a point where we've raised enough money where they'll say, okay, you've got enough progress. We're interested.
Yeah, I mean, people will take calculated risks. They won't take risks just to
right.
take risk. That's
right.
the other thing about this, right? And so proof of concept is huge, but that's a very quick pathway in 8 months. I mean, that's...
Well, and honestly...
You got to feel really good about
it.
I'd
like to be quicker, but it's time and money. And money, if you had money was no object, we could probably do some things differently.
Right.
Let me just say this, if I could. In the seed round of funding, what's attracted the investors
yeah.
is we have a convertible note that they're investing in, and those shares will convert to an A round. And they get a 20% discount. And at this phase, we're also giving 10% warrants, sweeteners,
mm-hmm.
to say thank you
mm-hmm.
for taking the risk in the early phase of the project.
Sure.
But every day, we're de-risking it by showing that we are measuring what we think we're measuring.
Absolutely, taking that out of it.
And we've got it. We just filed a patent, an IP, provisional. And now we're working on the regulatory strategy. So the good news is I have the roadmap, done it a few times. But, you know, this is other people's money, so you got to be a good steward of that money.
But your track record also, and having – this is not your first rodeo, so to speak, is
yeah.
also speaks volumes, because there's a lot of people that, you know, it's their first time. And no, not knocking them, but that also, from an investment perspective, is like, well, hold on.
It's a painful learning experience if you're an investor.
Yeah, why are you learning with my money?
Right.
Well, on that note, I would like to say thank you again. For being on the show.
Thanks, Rad. Appreciate it.
I appreciate it. You're welcome anytime. I do want to find out what happens in February.
Yes.
And what happens with the patent, because this is something definitely that I can personally see the benefit of. I did also mention that, you know, there's probably some ideas we can bounce around about how you can maybe try to collect the data
mm-hmm.
from sources that are not the usual clinical sources,
right.
because I really do believe it. If you don't have a migraine, fine. But, you know, you may have a severe headache. And I also think that this is probably something that will have further ripple effect benefits.
It will.
Not just solely for the migraine situation.
Yes, I would agree.
Appreciate you being here.
Thank you
for sharing.
Yes.
And thanks, everybody, for joining us on another episode of The Rad Life. We will be back next week with some more interesting journeys to share.
You have been listening to the Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gontos, brought to you on the one and only octalkradio.net. Join us again next week as we continue our journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older.